My Word.
A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is Michael O'Donnell.
Thank you very much, and welcome to another bout of competitive philology, etymology, terminology, and let's face it, occasional codology, from our teams of omniologists, Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, Antonia Fraser and Dennis Norton. And we start with a round called Unlikely Connections. Frank, what is the unlikely connection between the so-called ruthless rhymes and the Coldstream Guards?
The ruthless rhymes were written by Harry Graham, who was Eton and Sandhurst and Coldstream Guards.
Two marks, just like that. Well,
also wrote the lyrics of the Maid of the Mountains, didn't he?
Did he? Mm. Antonia, what do these have in common? Sir Christopher Wren, Nell Gwynn, and The Last Dodo.
I know The Last... I seem to remember, having worked on the reign of Charles II, that there was someone called Nell Gwynn in it. Christopher Wren rebuilt St. Paul's and etc. at the behest of Charles II. And I remember that The Last Dodo, I'm sure, died at the same time.
Yes, they were contemporaries, and we'll give you two marks. Well done. Dillis, what do these have in common? Trooper Silas T. Cummerbuck of the 15th Dragoons. Dragons, it says here. I've suddenly seen the script, but I'm sure it means the Dragoons, the 15th Dragoons. And the Ancient Mariner.
None, I should have thought, but...
it's an unlikely connection.
Very unlikely. I'm rather hampered by not knowing who on earth Mr. What's his name? Silas
something. Silas T. Cummerbach, which I think is spelled C O M E R B A C H, not
Cummerbach. I've never heard of him. Is he a real character?
No, he was a pseudonym.
A fictitious character.
He was an Irishman. Pseudonym, his name was.
And the Ancient Mariner.
Mm. Don't work too hard on it. Think of the most obvious connection there could be between the two, knowing that he's pseudonym.
No.
Was it the same man?
Yes. As
the writer of the as one of three.
He
St. Coleridge.
Dillis? Yes. Did you hear what Frank said?
No.
What
no.
Is the
message?
I was toying with the idea of Coleridge, don't you think?
Coleridge, were you?
Yes, Sam.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, Coleridge.
Well done, Dillis. It's the pseudonym he adopted when he did his brief spell of military service, which, according to Margaret Drabble, he did as a diversion from French revolutionary politics, heavy drinking, and an unhappy love affair. Eric. Dennis, but you'll see why.
Well, you just
listen and you'll discover where. It's what we call Doctor's Call and near Freudian slip. Dennis, the connection between Eric or Little by Little and Field Marshal Montgomery.
Oh, yes. What's his name? Farrar. Dean Farrar wrote Eric Littlebottom. And wasn't he Montgomery's great-grandparent? No, it wouldn't be great-grandparent. Grandparent, would he?
Grandfather.
Grandfather.
Well done. Two marks for them. Anybody read Eric? Little by Little.
I've read a bit of it. It's unspeakable.
Oh, no, I don't agree. Oh. It's got one of the great lines. Bother, said Eric. It was his first swear word. After that, things went rapidly downhill.
I only heard of it through music hall comedians. It was always quoted. It was a sort of, when they were looking for Desperate Search for Innuendo when I was a boy. But never knew it existed as a book. Well, before we go on to round two, here, Frank and Dennis, are the quotations you were given for the last round. Frank's is Eureka, and Dennis's is Too Marvellous for Words, song by Johnny Mercer and Richard Whiting, dating all the way back to 1937, though you'd never know it the way that Dennis sings it. Our next round is more familiar and troublesome, my word, territory, origins and derivations. Frank, what is the origin of at sixes and sevens?
If in doubt with these things, it's sport, it's archery or tilting. Or something. And I think I've read somewhere that this is it's rather mysterious actually. It's a very good example of origins and derivations that never have a clean answer. Mm. It's something to do with dice, isn't it?
Mm. Yes, it is.
There isn't a seven on a dice.
No. But it is said to be...
It means higgledy-piggledy, doesn't it? All at sixes and sevens. Mm. It's something to do with something about playing dice. Mm.
Well, your favourite dictionary, which I consulted a slightly later edition than the one you possessed, Johnson.
Johnny.
I looked it up this afternoon, and he attributes it to dicing, in quotes Bacon and Shakespeare. But Chaucer, actually, gives another, or suggests in a line that I'm not going to try and wrap my tongue around. People who read the line in Chaucer attribute the origin to a dispute between two livery companies, the merchant tailors and the skinners, about who should be sixth and who should be seventh when they process through the city, which is slightly more interesting. It's almost too interesting to be the real origin.
We'll probably never know, but certainly not this evening.
Well, we'll give you 2 marks anyway. Well done, Frank. Antonia, the origin or derivation of dressed up to the nines.
Dressed up to the nines.
Would it be on a scale of 10?
It isn't actually. Think of it anatomically and sort of going...
Oh, I see, yes.
Up to near the top.
Top, yes. So the nines might be. Can you mean that?
Well, no, higher.
Oh, right. The ears.
Well, very near, yes. Think of ancient words for another sense organ other than the ears.
Nine, no.
I only have nines for you, said the...
Oh, eyes. Dressed up to the eyes.
Up to the... Do you know what the obsolete word for eyes was?
I think nine would be a fairly good guess.
Shall I give you one and put you out of your agony? Because I don't think I can help you anymore. Eyne, E-Y-N-E, is the Old English for eyes. Well done for that one, Mark. And Dillis, the origin of the Grapes of Wrath.
That's a bit of American history. Hmm. That's John Brown's body lies a bowling in the grave. It's a battle hymn of the American Republic, isn't
it? That's it. We'll give you 2 marks for that.
Mine eyes have seen the coming of the glory of the Lord, the vineyard where the grapes of wrath are stored.
You make me feel like Steve Race. do you know, Dillis, who wrote the lyric of the Battle Hymn of the Republic?
It was a woman. She was called Howe.
That's right.
Something rather... Julia... Something Howe.
That's right, Julia Ward Howe.
And Indian,
not sure. And our word setter, Peter Moore, thinks that she might have been inspired by the Book of Revelation, the passage that goes, and the angel gathered the vine of the earth and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. So that's, anyway, you've got your marks. Dennis, origin of a conspiracy of silence. We've got one in the studio.
That That wouldn't have an origin in the same way as dressed up to the nines, would it? No. In other words, it's not a sort of corrupted phrase. It's just a question of finding the first person who said it, I suppose.
It wasn't all that long ago. Do you remember the
No.
It's an incident.
Sounds like Macaulay, doesn't it? That it's
It's an incident that involved Oscar Wilde.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
No? Well, it was coined by a mediocre Victorian poet called Sir Lewis Morris, who, irked by the apathy of reviewers to his work, asked Oscar Wilde what he should do about this conspiracy of silence, because he was getting no reviews, to which Oscar replied, "Join it." Now we come to a rather fanciful round called Newfangled Nursery Rhymes. Some feminists, it seems, have rewritten Little Miss Muffet as Sturdy Ms. Muffet, who eats the spider, not the curds and whey, and the tabloid newspapers are always trying to persuade us that there are anti-racists trying to rewrite Bar Bar Black Sheep. Though I don't believe a word of it. I just wondered if you'd like to turn yourselves momentarily into bigoted reformers and suggest other nursery rhymes whose titles or contents urgently in need of correction. Frank.
As a member of the Barber's Unit, I think Bar Bar Black Sheep is most inappropriate. Yes. Well, we must change, mustn't we, a well-known one to person bird, fly away home. The house is on fire. And as I was going to St. Ives, I met a man with seven living non-married consorts.
That will do very nicely, sir. Thank you very much. Antonia, what would you rewrite?
Well, I've got a great deal of sympathy with the feminists. When I was a little girl, apparently I made a terrible scene whenever my mother described the white horses drawing the coach of Cinderella, and I screamed, "No, mares, mares, white mares." So I think I'll keep it up and adapt Ryder Cock Horse. Ride a grey mare to Banbury Fair to see a fine fellow upon a white horse with rings on his fingers and bells on his toes. For music. He'll have a transistor wherever he goes.
You'll do very well. He'll probably get a record in the top 10 as well, won't he? Dillis.
I had an underprivileged childhood. I never learnt any nursery rhymes. I can't
never
think
of... Never too late.
Oh, I begin now. The only thing one I can think of is "This little piggy went to market." And that's rather rude, isn't it?
I think we ought to say,
"This little worthy went to market." Yes. Or making it political, of course, in view of the fact there are always elections ahead. We could say, "This little Thatcher went to market."
Oh, very fair, very fair.
It's very fair. Yes. It's quite polite, isn't it?
Yes.
Not rude.
No, you were, I'm afraid you're not all going right to be Dame Dillis now, but you're going to get 2 marks. Well done. Dennis.
Alongside feminism and racism, the other great crime today is to encourage people to eat the wrong kind of food. So I would suggest that the Queen was in the parlour eating bran-enriched brown bread and soybean spread. What are little girls made of? Artificial sweetener and non-fat spice.
Here's something to listen to. It's a chance excerpt from The Beth Book by Sarah Grand. It was published in 1897. And it goes, "The sky was an exquisite deep blue just then, with filmy white clouds drawn up over it like gauze." 2 points for the first person who can tell me why that sentence is worthy of note.
Is it translated from something?
No, that was the way I read it, but it isn't translated.
You read it very well, all things considered.
Should you have sung it?
No, no. It's one of these...
It's like the Quick Brown Fox. I always suspect a sentence with a Z in it.
Yes, yes. I quickly say why.
Because it's got all the letters of the alphabet.
It is as simple as that. Too much. So that
read it again so that we may relish all the letters.
Well, I'll try and accent all the letters.
Best voice.
The sky was an exquisite deep blue just then, with filmy white clouds drawn up over it like gauze. There we are.
Could have got azure in there, didn't they, blue. I didn't like the gauze, did you?
No. You don't, no, I think if the sky had been azure, then he'd have had any... Could have got the B somewhere else. We'll get to work on it after the break.
As you like it.
Was it written intentionally with all the...
No, well, I don't know. You see, Peter Moore, who digs these things out, sometimes digs them out from by happenstance. He just says it is a chance excerpt. Yeah. So it probably wasn't, but it was probably used by typists as something different from the Quick Brown Foxes. So now let us turn to much more serious things. And shout Eureka like Archimedes, because that's Frank's phrase.
I get a very large mail, as you'd expect a man in my position to get. For instance, this morning my credit card bill came in, together with 8 identical letters from the chairman of the company inviting me to join it. I also get, as you would expect, extensive fan mail. And if I might just read you this one, which came. Dear Mr. Muir, I wonder if anyone has told you how dislikable you are. Dislikable is underlined. I cheer when Dennis Norden wins. You always try desperately to draw attention to yourself and show off appallingly. Perhaps you think not being able to say your R's is sexy and attractive. But I can assure you it is stultifyingly boring. I wish you would fall down a well. Signed, a well-wisher. Apart from the last bit, which I put in as a joke, to cheer you up, that is a true letter, and it comes from the Fulham area of London. And I'm a bit worried whether this gentleman is right, and I don't think he is, about not being able to say your R's is a bad thing. Because I would remind well-wisher of ancient Greece, when there was this girl, Rose, who lived in Rhodes. And Rose was a musician. She was a flautist. And 3 likely lads fell in love with her. They were 3 Greeks. The first of these was a playwright. And he was a very flamboyant character. They used to call him Horace Toffynose. And Horace Toffynose wanted to get away from the Greek tragedy, which was 9 hours long, and everybody cut off their children's arms, and it was awful. And he said to Rose, "I'm going to do this big play, and then we'll get married." And said Horace, "I've got this idea. It'll fill the Hippodrome for years." He said, "I'm going to write a farce, French farce, and old judges falling out of cupboards without their trousers on." He said, "Do you know how the French really have fun? I'll just call it The Frogs." And he said, "So, will you marry me?" And she said, "No, I'm sorry." She said, I don't love you. I could admire you, but I couldn't love you." And then she got into the second one of these 3, whose name was Dodgy Knees. But kind of philosopher. And it was Diogenes, old Dodgy, who was, when the king fell asleep in front of the fire, when he was supposed to have been minding the cakes, it was Dodgy Knees who said, "Alexander the Great!" And from that moment on, that's what the king was known as. Dodgy Knees said, "Will you marry me?" She said, "Both you and old Horace Toffynose, you shout at me." Then she met this delightful little inventor. He always, when he was a child at school with the other 2, he always used to want to go to Australia, and they called him Ocker.
Archimedes, his name was. And he used to work for this firm that made pots, amphora to hold wine. And he used to invent everything they wanted. He invented a slogan for them. He said, do a tiny, tiny pot, and then do a very, very big pot. And there's a slogan in between, amphora penny, amphora pound. And he was very, very gentle and had a very soft voice, and he couldn't pronounce his R's, well-wisher. And he would say, Rose, Rose, you're so wonderful. I suppose you wouldn't marry me. And she said, yes, I would. Said the others just shouted and barked at me, but the way you say Rose, Rose is so sexy and attractive. And that is the reason that I love you, because you've got something very special about you. And he said, what's that? And she said, your weak hour.
Well done, Frank. Always like a story with a happy ending. Now, Dennis, let's see how you get on with Too Marvellous for Words.
Well, that sums up a very sad story. What happened after Frank and I stopped writing together? You see, because there may not be that many people whose memory goes back that far, back in the 50s and 60s, we used to write television and radio scripts together under the rather artful nom de plume of Muir and Norden. collaboration, incidentally, that seemed to puzzle quite a few people. How can two chaps write a script together, they used to ask. Well, of course, all it entailed, really, was dividing the work up efficiently. So Frank used to write all the nouns, adjectives and prepositions. I looked after the verbs, adverbs and pronouns. And it worked out very presently till, as was perhaps inevitable, Frank, who's always been of a somewhat literary bent, began feeling the urge to write a few adverbs and pronouns of his own. So, as I was becoming similarly restless for my own, whatever it was I wrote, oh yes, we decided to split up, abandon script writing altogether, and each concentrate instead on becoming a book author. And to show just how amiable that parting was, let me tell you what we did. We made a pact that each of us would take as our very first piece of solo literary work the writing of a foreword to the other's book. Frank to supply one that would be a preface to my book, my preface to go at the front of his. And do you know what? Those two prefaces turned out to be the best pieces of writing either of us has ever done. To quote the words of one impartial critic who happens to have read both of them, acute, sensitive, perceptive, in every sense, twin fingertips laid upon the pulse beat of our cultural sensibilities. Now, you know how rarely one gets that kind of comment from Jim Davidson, but it is a fact that when I read Frank's piece for me, the problem it posed was, how could I come up with a book that would be worthy of it? Which is probably why I made any number of false starts. My first intention, you see, had been to write a rattling good sea story of the Captain Hornblower type, but I had to abandon that, mainly because I kept getting confused about the number of apostrophes in the word forecastle. So I had a go instead at one of those steamy, hard-hitting novels depicting today's alienated youth culture. But that also got nowhere because I couldn't decide whether to make my hero a sex-crazed drug fiend or a drug-crazed sex fiend. So I then went on and I toyed with a couple of thriller ideas, one about foiling a Russian plan to drop superglue on American weapon bases, so that all the missiles would stick to the launching pad. And the other had to do with a demented news agent who poisons the local reservoirs in an attempt to get rid of his surplus stock of get-well cars. But in both cases, every time I glanced at that noble piece of Frank Muir prose that it would be prefaced by, I don't know, nothing seemed good enough. Then I thought, well, maybe I'll feel less inhibited if I try a work of non-fiction. And I was considering something along the lines of Lives of the Great Upholsterers when it occurred to me that I might be better advised to go in for one of those works of historical biography that Antonia handles so well. So I embarked on one dealing with the life stories of two of our most eminent 18th century prime ministers, and I even got as far as finding a good title for it. It's The Pits. When the same thing happened again, I looked at Frank's preface and I thought, how can I ever match that kind of excellence? So I gave up. And here's the strange thing. When I rang Frank up to tell him and to inquire how his book was progressing, I found he'd experienced it him dead in his tracks. And that's why there is still no published work of any consequence from either of us. In fact, as regards our output for the printed page, all we can really lay claim to is just two marvellous forewords.
Thank you very much, Dennis. While you were giving us that touching account of the literary life, our scorer handed me a sealed envelope containing the names of the winners. And just to heighten the tension a little, I thought I'd read them out in reverse order. So the team to come in second was Antonia and Dennis. The winners of the plastic laurel leaves are... Wait for it. Dillis and Rice. And until we all meet again, goodbye.
In My Word, Michael O'Donnell was in the chair. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the programme was produced for the BBC by Tony Shrine and Pete Atkin. You've been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.